I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. In his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan journeyed to feedlots and farms investigating our nation's food chain. In subsequent volumes, he examined how and what we eat and the impact these choices have on our health. And now he's returned to his own kitchen to explore fire, water, air, and earth, and how they fit into his cooking philosophy. This hour, we'll learn the secrets of a barbecue pitmaster and that magic touch for making the fermented goodies we all love, cheese, beer, and pickles. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Michael Pollan is known for keeping things simple when it comes to our food, nutrition, and eating. For his 2009 book, In Defense of Food, Pollan offered 7 words for how to eat better. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Now he's out with a new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, and in it he offers more pithy but oh-so-brief counsel when it comes to food. The most important thing about your diet, he writes, is not a nutrient but an activity, cooking. Pollan's new book is a celebration of the fact of a celebration of the act of cooking and a commentary on the fact that we used to do so much less of it than these days than we used to and what that means for all of us. Michael Pollan is also the author of 3 other New York Times bestsellers, Food Rules, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and The Botany of Desire. Pollan was named to the 2010 Time 100, the magazine's annual list of the world's 100 most influential people. He'll be back in Kansas City in a few days. Michael Pollan joins us now on the phone from New York. And Michael, welcome back. So good to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be back on your show.
You've been a major force in this country for smarter eating and healthier ways of growing food. How much progress are we making?
Good question.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's kind of the best of times and the worst of times. We see this renaissance of local food production going on and artisanal food production. It's really exciting what's happening. Farmers markets are booming. The local food economy has never, I shouldn't say never been this big, but it's up to like $7 billion in local food, not just counting organic. Organic's another $36 billion. So we're building around us an alternative food economy, and that's very exciting. At the same time, we haven't taken a big bite out of McDonald's. They're doing just fine, and industrial food is going on its merry way, and obesity is going on its merry way, too. So although actually the obesity numbers have ticked down a little bit, and it'll take a couple more years to know if this is a real, whether we've bottomed out here or it's just the bad economy means that people are, can't afford as much food. And we also see some large food companies starting to support local and organic agriculture. That they're, even food service, and this is the people who cook for institutions. I'm in Chicago right now, and I was talking to somebody who organizes a trade show, and he said that at his last one, this is for local farmers, and the O'Hare food concessions all wanted local food that they can put in the O'Hare food concessions. That's an amazing idea. So there is change happening, and I'm very hopeful. But we have a long way to go.
You know, how much of this schism in our culture when it comes to food sort of boils down to class differences and the cost of food? I mean, folks who obviously earn more money are a little better off and they can afford to buy local, buy more nutritious food, which is more expensive than folks who of lesser means.
Well, there's always been a class bias in food, and that the rich usually have better diets because they can afford better ingredients. And things are no different now. But I think that the food movement, the good food movement, is very concerned with democratizing good quality food. And it is a problem in this country because we subsidize the worst food in the market. We subsidize, high fructose corn syrup, and we subsidize soy oil that the fast food is all fried in. And we don't do much at all to subsidize the production of vegetables, which is what we all should be eating more of. So with the result, since the 80s, the price of fresh produce is up 40%, while the price of soda is down 7%. Hmm. So, you know, this class bias is kind of built into our agricultural policies, which are going to have to change if we want everybody to have healthy food. But I have to say that, you know, a lot of that discrimination can be undone through the act of cooking. One of the interesting studies I came across when I was doing research for this book is that poor women who cook actually eat healthier diets than rich women who don't.
Huh.
So that you can undo that class bias by cooking, because cooking is, you know, at bottom, very economical. You can even afford to shop at the farmer's market if you're cooking yourself and not going to restaurants. Cooking is, you know, in terms of improving people's diet and their food security, their ability to feed themselves, these skills are critical.
You know, but one of the central points of your book, Michael, and you know this way better than I, is that we're getting away from cooking. We're not doing as much of it as we used to because we're moving too quickly. We don't take the time to do it, which is what cooking is all about. One of the great pleasures of cooking is slowing down and taking time to appreciate what we have. So what about that? We're going away from cooking, not toward
it. We are. I mean, cooking is in, you know, home cooking has been declining since the 60s. We only spend 27 minutes a day cooking now. We were spending twice that much in 1965.
Wow.
We're also cooking fewer family meals and eating less together. Secondary eating is on the rise. That's eating while you're doing other things, cooking while you're eating while you're cooking, or eating while you're watching TV, or eating while you're in the car, or eating at work. We're now spending more time engaged in secondary eating than we're spending in primary eating, which is a newfangled way of saying meals. And we're only spending 64 minutes on meals. So, the trend is going in the wrong direction. We are outsourcing our cooking to large corporations, and with disastrous results. Why are we doing this? Well, we are really busy. We work longer hours than people in any other industrialized country. But I think it's important to remember that people find time for whatever they think is important. You know, we make it to the gym because we know it's really important to our health and our sanity. We make it to the yoga class. We're all spending 2 hours a day on the internet. This is new time. Just in the last 10 years, this is time spent on the internet, not counting work. So we find time, and we've just devalued cooking. We just don't think it's important. And what I'm trying to do in this book is show people how important it is and how pleasurable it is. That in the same way I make that point to get my exercise session in every day, I now make it my point to spend at least a half hour and sometimes up to an hour cooking. And I find that's just as important to my sanity. It's when I get to reconnect to my senses, to my wife and my son. It's when I disconnect from screens and media. And it is just that great moment of just kind of resetting at the end of the day.
You know,
I think we're being robbed of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone's going to disagree with what you just said. I do wonder if you're preaching into the wind here, in a sense that, you know, society is clearly going one way, and can you stop the train, which has already clearly left the station, and sort of reverse this macro trend, which is so fully underway in our society right now?
Well, you know, I'm an optimist. I mean, I started writing about agriculture and things like grass-fed beef when they were mere mm-hmm. blips, you know, organic
That's
agriculture.
That's right, you did.
And not just me, by the way. I don't want to take credit for this. I mean, you know, Eric Schlosser and there are a lot of people who have been writing about these issues going back to the 70s. And that was preaching into the wind, believe me, that we could have a more sustainable agriculture, that we could diversify our farms, that we could actually put animals back on farms and get them out of feedlots. Well, all that is starting to happen. I think that, you know, the power of information, the power of showing people
yeah.
what's going on right under their nose does lead to changes in behavior. And I'm hoping to inspire that with this book. And to do it not by lecturing people or telling them they should be doing something, but by reminding them of these powerful experiences and how good it feels to cook a meal for your family and how grateful they will be and the wonderful interactions that unfold at the table that we miss when we engage in secondary eating.
We're visiting with Michael Pollan. He's the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's out with a new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He joins us on the phone this morning from Chicago. Michael, I want to go back to this idea you just said a few minutes ago about the consequences of sort of what we're doing here. Because you write this in your new book, Cooked. You say this, it is entirely possible that within another generation, cooking a meal from scratch will seem as exotic and ambitious, as extreme, you write, as most of us today regard brewing beer or baking a loaf of bread or putting up a crock of sauerkraut. So again, that raises this big question which you pose in the book. What is the consequence of more consequences of what we're doing here by not spending more time cooking?
Well, the first one is health. You know, when you look at the causes of the obesity epidemic, a couple things jump out from the statistics. We're eating about 500 more calories a day. What kind of calories are they? Well, they're by and large calories that are cooked by corporations making snacks, snack foods, and beverages. And most of the extra eating we're doing is secondary eating. It's not food we're taking in at mealtimes. If you track the decline in cooking and the rise in obesity, they proceed in lockstep. They are the same phenomenon. And if you look around the world, the cultures that are still doing home cooking and eating family meals have the lowest rates of obesity. And so, in the same way that we have public health messages, warning people the dangers of soda consumption, which we need, we should have public health messages, convincing people to get back in the kitchen and mm-hmm. have family meals. It doesn't seem like a health message, but it is. And that there are things about the very nature of cooking that will kind of nudge you in the direction of healthier food. And that's what I mean when I say it really doesn't matter what nutrients or calories that you're cooking. You're not going to cook French fries twice a day. It's mm-hmm. just too much work. You're not going to make dessert every day. It's too much work. You're going to get the best ingredients you can afford and cook them in a very simple way. And your diet will be so much better than any kind of restaurant diet, any kind of fast food diet. And the reason is that corporations cook in a certain style. And we could call that style salt, fat, and sugar in abundance, and plus lots of food additives to keep the stuff looking better and tasting better than it really is. I kind of despair of corporations learning how to really cook healthy food. And part of the reason is that their business model involves cheapest possible raw ingredients tricked up with salt, fat, and sugar, but also involves making us crave and overeat. Because, the margins in the food business are terrible. Mm-hmm. The population is not growing very fast in this country. So the way you make money if you're a food processor is process more, provide new convenience, new gimmicks, new ways to deliver foods, brand extensions, turn your Oreo cookie into a straw to sip milk from or whatever it is, but also to get heavy users to use more. It's very hard to create a new soda drinker today. People are getting the message about soda. So they double down and try to get the soda drinkers they have to double their consumption. So they don't have our interests at heart in a way that a parent cooking for a child clearly has that child's interest at heart.
Now, I love this, Michael. You talked to a man named Harry Balzer. He's a food industry market researcher who has some not-so-kind words about what some people consider cooking these days. What did Harry Balzer tell you?
Well, he was one of my teachers. I learned a lot about the food industry from him, and he works for the food industry. And he's convinced that home cooking is dead or about to be dead, and mm-hmm. And that even when people report to market researchers that they're cooking, and officially we're cooking 57% of our meals, I think, their definition of cooking is like nuking a pizza in the microwave. that doesn't really count as cooking to me. So his firm, though, even has a definition of cooking that is not too stringent. basically, cooking is any combination of any assembly of ingredients. So if you're pouring bottled salad dressing over pre-washed lettuce, you're cooking. If you're putting a slice of turkey on bread, making a sandwich, you're cooking. This isn't exactly what we used to call scratch cooking, but it's better than nothing. But Harry Balzer also said something really interesting to me when I was talking about, we were talking about the obesity epidemic and the problems with the industry he works for, and he was very frank about it. And he said, "You want to know one diet that will work for America?" And I said, "Yeah." And I took out my pen. I was eager to write. And he said, "Eat anything you want as long as you cook it yourself."
Huh, there you go.
And, you know, that is
there
one of
go.
The most important, you know, and that's from deep in the belly of the beast. But that is very important advice. They understand that the way they're cooking, you're going to eat the wrong things, and they're going to have way too much salt, fat, and sugar in them.
Yeah. Well, Michael, if home cooking is so dead, why does the Food Network then have such a huge audience?
Well, that's a really interesting paradox that I explore in the book.
Yes, you
because,
do.
You know, we're spending on average 27 minutes a day cooking, 4 minutes cleaning up. Yet we're watching in unprecedented numbers these programs on the Food Network and other networks. What does that mean? Millions of Americans are spending much more time watching other people cook on TV than they're spending cooking themselves. So, you know, you ask where the time is going to come from. Well, I've got one good candidate right there.
Yeah.
Just skip one episode of Chopped and try to make something yourself. The problem with those cooking shows, though, is that I don't think they really encourage people to cook. I think they make cooking look really hard and intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got knives flying dangerously around the room. You've got fountains of flame. You've got a time clock ticking down the minutes like the end of a basketball game. This looks scary. This looks like something you want to leave to the professionals. And that's what, you know, that's how TV works. I mean, TV is never in the business of motivating us to get up from the couch.
Yeah.
That would hurt TV. So I think we should tune out some of those shows and actually try this stuff ourselves. But the thing that I think explains that paradox is a little more hopeful. And that is, why do we like to watch this? We don't watch people fixing our cars, and we don't watch TV shows about people sewing
right.
our clothing. We've outsourced a lot of stuff in life, and we haven't looked back. Cooking is different. I think we all have very powerful memories of being cooked for, of being in the kitchen with our moms or our grandmothers.
You bet.
And that feeling of someone you love making something delicious that you like, we miss it. I think we miss cooking. And we don't think we have the skills, and we don't think we have the time. And my argument is that we can find our way back into the kitchen, and that we're missing one of the great satisfactions of life by exiling ourselves from that place.
Well, I want to go back to a stat you threw out a few minutes ago about the average family spends 4 minutes cleaning up from a meal. I don't know about where those families are, but that's sort of my job in my family, and I'm spending a lot more than 4 minutes every night cleaning up the Kraske kitchen.
You know, I agree. I think there's something fishy about that number. And
yes.
what it tells me, though, is that those people aren't really cooking. They're just calling it cooking. 4 minutes, you can crumple a pizza box, and you can scrape a plate and put it in the dishwasher. But you can't actually clean a pot
yes.
in that amount of time.
I'm with you on that one. Michael Pollan is our guest. He's the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, the huge mega bestseller. His latest book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Hey, he'll be in town at 7 o'clock on Friday evening, May 10th, a couple weeks from now, at Unity Temple on the Plaza, 707 West 47th Street. You can call Rainy Day Books in Fairway for more information, 913-384-3126. If you have a question for Michael Pollan on your kitchen and cooking, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, up to date. At KCUR.org or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to some calls here. Some folks waiting very patiently. Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning. You there, Mike? A listener writes us this at KCU at up to date at KCUR.org to ask, since so few ocean fish are in a sustainable state, I just buy farm raised catfish and tilapia. Is that a good idea?
Well, you know, the writer is right to be concerned about ocean fish, and they are kind of in free fall. And mm-hmm. But there are some sustainable choices, and it's worth trying to explore and see what they are. Some kinds of tilapia is a fairly sustainable fish because you don't have to feed it other fish. It'll eat lots of different things.
Yeah.
And so one of the problems with most aquaculture is that you're feeding them fish that the food chain in the seas needs, and so we're hurting fish that way too. I don't know how catfish is raised though domestically. There are some sustainable forms of salmon farming. You have to really ask. It tends to be from there are places in Scotland and Ireland that are doing it sustainably. And wild salmon is sustainable if mm-hmm. you can find that. It's often expensive. It's delicious. Halibut from Alaska is sustainable. The Alaskan fishery is one of the healthier ones. And don't forget shellfish. Shellfish is a very sustainable when it's grown in aquaculture. It actually cleans the water and doesn't have to be fed. And so that's a very good option. Mussels, clams, oysters, things like that.
Okay, back to some calls here. Brad from Prairie Village, around with Michael Pollan. Brad, good morning.
Hi there. I was wondering if you'd want to comment on the fourth man of the apocalypse, starch.
You know, look, starch, I mean, refined carbohydrates are a problem. Pure starch can be a problem. But when you have starch in the company of fiber and other things, like in a whole grain, it's fine. It's fine. It's all about balance. The thing we've done with grain is we've sheared off the healthiest part, the bran and the germ, and we have this, you know, this white flour. And these refined grains are a problem. And so one of the things I explore in the book is this turning point. You know, most of the history of cooking has been developing of technologies that makes food more nutritious, not less. And then beginning in 1880, we turned the corner, and we figured out a way to process food to make it less healthy, and that was white flour. And then refined sugar was around the same time. So I think we really – I love starch. I'm a great starch eater. I have a weakness for starch, but I do eat whole grain now, and I don't eat white flour, whenever I can. I mean, if I'm in a restaurant and they're serving baguettes, I can't resist. But I do – I bake with whole grains, and I eat whole grain pasta, and I think it's delicious, actually. I've really acquired a taste for it. And so if you're getting your starch with some germ and some bran, you're getting a really healthy food.
I hope that helps, Brad.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking of all the refined foods and the soy flour and the potato flour and the rice flour that's showing up for more of filler and form than actual food substance.
Yeah, no, you're right, and it's empty calories. It's not that different than soda. I mean, it turns to those refined grains turn to sugar on your tongue. It's all glucose, and it'll give you energy, but energy is the last thing we need in our diet.
Brad, thank you.
Thanks.
Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Emily from Lawrence. Emily, you're on the show. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Pollan, you were talking a little bit about this, but I'm wondering if you're seeing or you have predictions, can you see the future? Are we moving away, are the big national grocery store brands and things like that moving away from things like high fructose corn syrup, food dyes, genetically modified things, or are they just like making a big to-do about a little inching toward that?
I think we are moving away. It's fitful, but one of the fastest growing categories in the supermarket industry right now is GMO-free foods, and they're hustling to make them. I think that there is an aroused consumer out there who really cares about this thing. And high fructose corn syrup too. There are hundreds of new products that have been or old products that have been formulated to take out high fructose corn syrup. But I will say that these are not panaceas. If you eat food without GM, you know, you're basically taking your food back to 1996, which was not a golden age for food. I mean, we were using tons of pesticides then, and it doesn't guarantee a sustainable product. It just doesn't have GM in it. Ditto high fructose corn syrup. You can remove that from your food and replace it with sugar. And, you know, great, you're not eating high fructose corn syrup, but you're still getting probably more sugar than you want. So the industry is trying to appear to respond to the modern consumer's concerns about food, sometimes in meaningful ways and sometimes in borderline deceptive ways. I just don't think, you know, the problem with high fructose corn syrup is not that it was worse for you than sugar. That was never my argument or really many people's argument at all. It's that it was a sign of processed food, because humans don't cook with high fructose corn syrup. Only corporations do. So that if you avoided it, you tended to avoid you know, the worst, most processed foods. But the industry is really clever. I mean, I've put out lots of different rules that they have figured out ways to use to sell more junk. You know, I mean, I've been saying, and I'm not the only one, a lot of people have been saying, don't buy foods with more than five ingredients. And then Haagen-Dazs discovered that their ice cream only had five ingredients. So they started boasting about it, and they called it five, implying it was therefore healthy. Hmm. Nothing changed. It was the same old, same old. So the industry is very clever about taking the critique of industrial food and using it to sell more industrial food.
All right. Emily, thank you for the call.
Thank you so much. Keep up the good work.
You bet.
Thank you.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with Michael Pollan about his new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. We'll talk about his meeting with a barbecue master in North Carolina. We'll ask him why he didn't come to Kansas City. And we'll also talk with a master bread maker, what he learned from lessons from two master bread makers that he met with. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's conversations about voting rights and my son's college selection decision, you can find those in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Well, the U.S. is withdrawing its influence from many regions of the world, and Russia and China are stepping in to fill the gap. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about what this means for American foreign policy down the road. Well, this hour, we're visiting with Michael Pollan. He's the author of the huge bestseller, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's back with his latest book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He'll be in town on Friday night, May 10th, at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Renity Books in Fairway to grab a seat, 913-384-3126. If you want to join our conversation right now, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, up-to-date at kcur.org, or you can also tweet us at kcurup-to-date. We have some more folks who want to visit with you here a little bit. Michael, Nathan from Lawrence, you're on up-to-date. Nathan, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was wondering, you mentioned that that food started becoming less nutritious by, 1880, but recently, since I don't really like wheat, the whole wheat pasta, I've been buying this stuff called Dreamfields pasta, which is made from semolina durum wheat still, but it has the taste of starchy, white, refined pasta, but it has it's supposed to not have any digestible or hardly any digestible carbs.
And I was really? I'm not familiar with that product. I'm going to have to look for it. What's the name again?
Dreamfields pasta.
Hmm.
Dreamfield. All right, I'll look it up.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a complex, or it's like in a matrix, they call it.
Interesting.
What about other foods, Michael, that have been engineered to be healthier? And which I guess sort of raises a question in my mind. None of this shopping business, it seems to be getting more complicated rather than easier. You don't really know what to believe a lot of times when you're buying stuff in the supermarket.
Well, that's right. There's a lot of confusion and there's a lot of deception. Everything is sold to us on the basis of a health claim. And one of my food rules is don't buy foods that have health claims.
That's right.
The healthiest food in the store is silent. It's in the produce section. And it's not bragging about it itself, but it's really healthy. I look forward to, you know, food science figuring out how to engineer foods to make them genuinely more healthy, but I can't think of too many examples. the best innovations in processed food were really, you know, learning how to freeze vegetables at the peak of their ripeness in the field. And that gave us, you know, these I think frozen vegetables are really underrated. I think they're terrific and very economical way to eat and get your vegetables when fresh produce is expensive. Some of them are mushy, but a lot of them are great. I mean, frozen spinach is terrific. But, I can't, and fortification has helped in some cases relieve chronic, deficiencies and things like power. But in general, I don't think we've done much to improve food for health. The focus has been on convenience. We have a whole lot of gluten-free products now, and everybody assumes they're all healthier. In fact, a lot of them are not healthy. To switch from white wheat flour to white rice flour, you're not doing yourself any favors unless you have a real allergy or intolerance of gluten. As soon as people see the words gluten-free, they assume this is somehow good. Now, gluten is not carbs. Gluten is a form of protein, and it's been very important to humankind for most of our history. Now we're demonizing it because there are a small number of people who struggle with it, but a lot of other people think they struggle with it. And so people are switching to other things that they assume are healthier, but aren't always. There's a lot of gluten-free products that are really highly processed and not good for you at all.
Michael Rick from Independence writes us this at UpToDate at KCUR.org. Where do kids fit into all of this? They want to eat what their friends eat and what they see on TV. They eat at their friends' houses, and the parents bring in KFC or take the gang out for burgers. I suspect many parents would like to eat healthier, but too often take the path of least resistance. What can be done to change this dynamic?
Well, I think that's right. I think it's a really good question. I think we need to take back control of our kids' diet. I mean, we've outsourced that to corporations too, and their marketing messages. Corporations are trying to get between you and your kid, and they want to decide what your kid, they want to give your kid the power to decide what they're going to eat and ask for. This has been going on for a very long time. We've all had the experience with a toddler in the supermarket, and the toddler's begging for this or that cereal, and because there's a cartoon image on it, and or something that's catching, or a prize in it, or whatever. But it's really the parent's job to decide what kids eat. Now, you can't always control it, and it's not like, when your kid goes to someone else's house, they're going to eat what's there. That's part of being a good guest. You eat what is being served. But in your own home, with your own kids, it is, I think it's a solemn parental responsibility to take control of your kid's diet to the extent you can. I mean, they have their preferences, obviously, but they should be choosing from choices you make, you offer. So therefore, we always kept soda out of the house. So it just wasn't an issue. But I also think a very important, overlooked fact is that we're not teaching our kids how to cook. We're cooking for them if we're cooking, or we're nuking food for them. Mm-hmm. But teaching your kids how to cook is one of the most important life skills you can impart. It will do more for their long-term health and happiness than just about anything. We put a lot into teaching our kids how to drive. We teach them about, how to use alcohol responsibly, and safe sex and all these things that are very important parental responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I would rank cooking right up there.
I want to go back to a couple of the stories, a couple of your journeys that you made in the course of preparing your new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. You went to Wilson, North Carolina to visit with a barbecue master there named Ed Mitchell. I'm not going to make a whole big fuss about the fact that you didn't come to Kansas City for this, but that's a different topic. But Ed taught you how to cook a whole hog over a fire. What did you learn from Ed Mitchell about cooking a whole hog over a fire?
Well, let me just to apologize to people in Kansas City.
Please.
I love Kansas City ribs, but it's not barbecue.
What do you mean it's not barbecue?
I'm just kidding. Because every barbecue school, barbecue is a very balkanized world down there, and everybody thinks what they're doing is barbecue, and everything else is just something else.
Mm-hmm.
but I was looking for the most kind of primordial, unreconstructed kind of cooking I could find, which is to say an animal, wood, fire, time. You know, I mean, the primary colors of ancient cooking. And it seemed to me that that tradition in eastern North Carolina, which is always whole hog, and western North Carolina is completely different, by the way, but it's whole hog cooked over a wood fire very slowly and no sauce. I mean, they do add some apple cider vinegar and sugar and salt, and, you know, they season it, but there's no sauce, and then they make a sandwich with it. That seemed to me so wonderfully basic that it would be a good place to reconnect with what's at the heart and soul of barbecue. I love the other styles too. I love Texas barbecue also. I love ribs, but this for me was, you know, the, I don't want to say the real thing, so I'll get in trouble, but it served my purposes as a writer. And what I learned is, first, how simple barbecue is. I mean, have we tricked this up, you know, to a ridiculous level? These self-dramatizing men who make it seem like they've got some, you know, there's always secrets. And as I say in the book, the secret of barbecue is that there are no secrets of barbecue, and that it's a very simple thing. And, yeah, people have their sauce recipes, and people fetishize that. And I remember I worked for somebody who went to Kansas City on business regularly, and he would always bring back a bottle of Arthur Bryant sauce.
Sure.
I was so excited, and I would spread it on everything and cook with it all the time. But, you know, I learned a lot about what happens to meat when it cooks slowly, and how it is tenderized, and how the meat, how the fat renders right into the meat, and also, you know, crackling. I mean, you don't get that with ribs. I mean, crackling is kind of God's food. I mean, it's really amazing stuff.
Crackling meaning what?
Crackling is the cooked skin of a pig. It is, and when it's cooked at a high temperature, this floppy, rubbery thing turns to glass, and then you with cleavers you break it up into little shards, and you mix it into your barbecued meat, and that gives it, they're almost like bacon bits in the midst of this meat. You've got to try it. It's really, really good. But anyway, so I learned a lot about these transformations of meat when you cook slowly over a very low temperature. Things happen that won't happen any other way. So it's taught me to be slower on the grill and to cook, you know, and to cook with moist heat. And so I think it's improved my general barbecuing. But what I do, they wouldn't call barbecue anywhere in the South.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's go back to some phone calls here for Michael Pollan. Diana from Parkville. Diana, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. As always, I love the show. And
thank you.
I'm still kind of in an afterglow from last night because my 20-something-year-old son fixed dinner for us, which is starting to become a regular occurrence. And if I was fixing a Sunday night dinner, I probably would have made a meatloaf or a lasagna, fried chicken or something like that, because that's how I grew up in the foods that I make. Well, he doesn't like what I cook anymore. So he made a grilled chicken with a honey glaze sauce, toasted pecans on a bed of quinoa, which I had never eaten or heard of before, and then surrounded it with fresh snow peas he had bought from the farmer's market. And he is so into healthy cooking these days that he makes the best meals in our house. And so, not that I would disagree with your author, but I think some of those cooking shows have inspired maybe a younger generation of chefs. At least this is what's happened in our house. He used to watch those cooking shows all the time, and now he's cooking, and he's cooking with ingredients and doing recipes that I never did when he was young. So, I just wanted to throw that into the conversation, but I did the cleanup in the kitchen. It took me 35 minutes.
Well, you're very lucky, and you're to be congratulated. You know, there are a lot of people, you know, even as cooking is fading in our culture, there are people who are rediscovering it, and I think there are people finding their way back to the kitchen. And what they're finding is it's a wonderful outlet for their creativity, and it is a wonderful way to express a feeling for other people by cooking for them. And yeah, it's and really I think that's interesting.
What my son is doing. Uh-huh.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, we talk about it as drudgery, and as you get in more deeply, that word doesn't cross your mind anymore. As you actually learn how to chop an onion and what's going on in an onion when you do that, as you learn a little bit of the science and the craft, I find it incredibly engaging intellectually. And what had seemed drudgery approached in that spirit of I'm in a rush. Once you settle into it and you say, all right, I'm going to be in the kitchen for the next hour. That's what I'm doing. What was drudgery becomes alchemy. It mm-hmm. becomes magic, mm-hmm. and it becomes right. incredibly rewarding.
And I think, yeah, as parents, we should, you know, the parent who's responsible for cooking the most of the meals should approach it in that reward, that rewarding feeling, and then kids will pick up on that as well. But my son didn't get that from me. I think he got it from the TV cooking shows. So anyway, just
well, that's great. I'm so happy to hear that somebody would be motivated by those shows, because I've always thought they had the opposite effect. But I do think, though, they are glamorizing cooking, and they show macho guys cooking, and that's inspiration to certain people, too. And that would probably be a very positive side. They're raising the profile of cooking as a worthwhile profession. And that is a good thing, but that doesn't always translate into home cooking.
Hey, do you have kids at home yourself, Michael, and are they engaged in cooking at the Pollen household?
I've got a son who's now in college, and he was engaged. He really liked to cook and would help out in the kitchen. You know, they have homework very often, but what he would do is do his homework in the kitchen at the counter where I would be cooking, and we would talk, and while he does homework and I'd cook, and he'd offer unsolicited seasoning advice, and no, he's got a very good palate, actually, and has spent time. He's worked in a kitchen as an intern, and so he can help me. He's very good at, like, butchering a chicken. He can do that better than I can. So I think cooking is a great way to connect with our kids, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have teenagers, you know that the face-to-face conversation is not always the best way to engage with
right.
them. That working together side by side
yep.
is often much more powerful and pleasant for everybody. And so we started brewing beer together, and that was when I was learning how to brew beer. He joined me in that pursuit.
Now that'll do it.
That will do it. Teenagers are always happy to brew beer and taste it. But it was, you know, it's a two-man job or a two-person job to brew beer, because you've got these heavy carboys you have to move around. And we had great fun doing that together. And I think one of our problems with cooking is that we've isolated cooking, and that getting the whole family in the kitchen, getting your kids involved, just makes it a lot more fun.
Grace from Kansas City wants to know, what are some of Michael Pollan's go-to weekday meals?
Oh, okay. Well, often I have something during the week that I actually made on Sunday. I'll often do a stew or a braise or a soup on Sunday if I'm hanging around the house,
mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, in the winter. And then I will defrost that or take it out of the fridge or chili or something like that. I make, you know, we still do grill. I'll marinate a piece of fish or something like that. And, you know, I live in California, so we can grill all year long. We make stir fries a lot with fresh vegetables and a little bit of meat. I mean, I try to use meat as a flavoring more than as a centerpiece of the meal,
because mm-hmm.
I think we all eat way too much meat. And I'd rather spend a lot of money on expensive, you know, on really high quality grass-fed meat or pastured poultry, but therefore I eat less of it. So we will stir fry that. I love making braises. These are slow cooked dishes where mm-hmm. you brown meat and then you add a little bit of liquid, not to cover, just halfway up the side of the meat, and put it in the oven with that liquid. It could be wine, it could be water, it could, in some dishes it's even milk, and slow cook it at like 220 degrees, sometimes all day. Sometimes I'll do it in a crock pot in the morning. And there's nothing nicer than coming home knowing
yeah.
that your dinner has been cooking all day and that it's perfumed the kitchen when you get there and mm-hmm. the work is done.
Derek writes us this at UpToDate at KCUR.org. Michael, can Michael Pollan explain how he thinks cooking all your own food squares with feminism and the fact that few of us can afford one partner to be a homekeeper any longer? Cooking three meals a day isn't something many of us can possibly do. As for the idea that we'd eat better if we cooked our own food, my grandmother cooked every meal she ate and was miserably unhealthy.
Well, I wonder if, you know, that's Paula Deen's grandson writing that letter. I don't know. I look at the gender politics of cooking in this book because they have been a big part of the problem. When I went to school, there was home ec for girls and shop for boys, and cooking was women's work. And my mother did all of it, and my dad did nothing. And that was an untenable situation. It was unsustainable, and indeed it fell apart when women went back to work, as well it should have fallen apart. But the industry kind of exploited feminism, I think, to worm its way into the kitchen. What was happening was, with the women's movement, there was a very uncomfortable conversation unfolding at kitchen tables all across America when basically to renegotiate the division of labor in the house. If women were working, they couldn't also be expected to do all the cleaning and the laundry and the cooking and the child care. And that was a very hard conversation. I was party to it also in my house. And what happened was the food industry saw an opportunity, and they leapt at it. And they said, hey, the cooking piece, we got it covered. Don't argue about it anymore. And KFC took out this brilliant billboard, which had a bucket of chicken and two words above it, women's liberation. And they basically redefined not cooking as the progressive thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let corporations cook for us. I think we need to – we're not going to turn back the clock, and we shouldn't turn back the clock. What we should be doing is completing that conversation. Men and women have to divide the domestic chores equitably. And in some families, it'll be the woman who wants to cook because she's good at it, or it'll be the man who wants to cook because he's good at it. Or – both will cook together, and that's what we do in our house. We every meal we divvy up who's going to do what, and sometimes I do the main, and Judith does the sides, or vice versa. And when we can get our son involved, and sometimes we'll just demand it, like before you do your homework, I need you to chop up that onion for me, or mince that garlic. Do some prep for me before you run off. And so, if we divide the work, it's doable. And if we're strategic about it, it's doable. And by the way, there are plenty of great 20-minute recipes that you can find online.
That's great.
So I'm not convinced that it's impossible to get the food on the table for the family. I really am not. And it's not going to happen 7 days a week, but if it happens 4 days a week, it's fantastic. And you've done so much for your family and your health, and you're going to have family meals, which are, you know, They're one of the most important institutions we have.
Yeah. Elaine from Lawrence, good morning. Elaine, are you there?
Yeah, this is Alain Deroulette in Lawrence, Kansas. Steve, thanks for the show. Appreciate. And Michael, appreciate also what you were saying earlier about parents need to take control over what the kids like to eat. I grew up in France where we didn't have choice. And if I have any issue with my parents, it's not that one. I'm so glad that I was able to eat pretty much anything. And when I went back last December, I was amazed. My little new nephew of 8 months old was eating pretty much almost everything the adult was eating. It was so impressive. Now, my question is, how could you change 2-3 generation of people eating industry or food?
Well, that's a great question, because
we've
lost a generation, and that cultural transmission of food culture and cooking skills. There are many parents who aren't equipped to teach their kids how to cook because they don't do it themselves. And that's why I think we're going to have to bring back home ec, among other things. We're going to have to come up with a sexier name for it. But teaching cooking skills in schools, I think, is really important. You know, we're teaching sex education and mm-hmm. how to deal with alcohol and drugs and driving and all these kind of things. And I think this is a life skill we need to teach. I also think, though, that parents learn to cook, they can teach their kids. And there are a lot of resources to learn how to cook if you don't know how to cook. There are during the day very helpful cooking shows, the ones that are much more empowering in how-to than the nighttime ones. There are incredible videos on YouTube from great chefs and ordinary chefs teaching you specific techniques, how to cut an onion, for example. There's a Jamie Oliver, you know, 1-minute video, all you need to know about cutting an onion.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best ways to learn, I think, is to, if you have someone in your circle who loves to cook, and let's say they bake great bread or make really good soups, offer to come over and help out and watch. You can learn so quickly when you're in the kitchen of someone who's good. That's what I discovered doing this. You can learn things you could never learn any other way by just being side by side, by feeling how the dough feels before it goes in the oven. When it's ready, you acquire a muscle memory that you couldn't learn any other way than touching it. And so I think that, you know, we're going to have to rebuild this culture of cooking. But your point about kids eating what adults eat is such a good one, because in America, you know, parents have been turned into short order cooks.
Yeah.
You know, there's
yeah.
so many families where there's several different things being cooked because each kid has their own way. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Well, Michael, you always do such a great job. It's always a pleasure to have you here, and we'll look forward to seeing you on May 10th when you're in town here in Kansas City.
Great. Always love coming to those rainy day events at Unity Temple.
You bet, Michael. All the best. Again, that's Michael Pollan, the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers. His latest book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Again, he speaks at 7 on Friday evening, May 10th, a couple weeks from now at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information, Rainy Day Books, 913-384-3126. The United States is withdrawing its influence from many regions of the world, and Russia and China are stepping in to fill the void. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about what this means for American foreign policy in the future. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.